Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange conference call. For opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Kathy Kuhn.
Thank you, Raymond, and welcome to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today, we are hosting an Ask the Expert session for data power topics on appliance reloads, MQ integration points, networking, SSL, FTP, and HTTP content type manipulation. My name is Kathy Kuhn, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we will introduce the panel of experts. Then a very short introduction to the topic for data power, topics on appliance, reloads, MQ integration points, network SSL, FTP, and HTTP content type manipulation. We will then answer all the pre-submitted questions, and then at that time, we will open up the lines for questions. Once all those questions have been answered, we will summarize the highlights of our session to slide number 3. At this time, I would like our panel of experts to introduce themselves today. Clarissa, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Clarissa Washington, Data Power Level 2 engineer, and my primary areas are security and networking.
Hi, I'm Dominic McCauley, and I'm also part of the L2 support team. My primary focus is in crash, and I've been part of the team for 8 years now.
My name is Jin Sahu. I also work with the team as a level 2 support, and I am the team lead, and also I work with my SME subject matter expert areas of MQ integration and B2B integration, as well as, you know, WSSR and some of the areas that integrate with the data power.
Hi, I'm Jim Barrett, a member of the Data Power and API Management Level 2 support teams. I've been a member of the Data Power team for 4.5 years. Touched a broad range of the product.
Hello, my name is Trey Williamson. I work in Data Power Level 2 support. Been here for quite a while. Primarily focus in network, and I dabble in just about every other part of the box that I can.
Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Magani. I worked in Data Power Level 2 support for about 6 years. I'm now working in the Accelerated Value Program. I'm an Accelerated Value Specialist for Data Power for a number of our customers. My primary specialty is the FTP, SFTP, and ODBC components of Data Power.
And now we're moving on to slide 4. At this time, our panel would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Paul will give us the introduction.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the call. So this presentation will be applicable to the firmware version 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, and 7.5. We're going to be covering topics such as SSL, FTP, MQ, appliance reloads, the Web GUI SSH access, and lastly, my colleague Jim is going to touch upon manipulating the content type header for requests and responses. So with that said, can we please move to slide number 5? And I shall hand the presentation over to my colleague, Trey, who will discuss how I can quickly access, assess, and get a key information from an appliance reload. Trey, if you would be so kind.
Absolutely. Thanks, Paul. So just like the question says, we want to quickly use some of the basic built-in status providers on the appliances so that we can ideally nail a problem down quickly and get it moving in the right direction. Rather than going off on a fishing expedition. If I could move to the next slide, please. So I'll be honest, there's only 2 little bullets on this, but they are kind of broad, and I expect questions. Before a reload ever occurs, basically from the moment after you create your user IDs, I would suggest to be sure to have the failure notification configured to always capture on startup. The always on startup option, just like the help says, if you click and go into it, it's going to tell you before any logs are overwritten, before any next step is taken, we're going to go ahead and tar up, create, zip up an error report right after a reload. The basic functionality is the plan behind this is that after an appliance reloads, it's going to come back up. It's going to reload the config. Logs are going to start filling up with the new boot up, with the new config load, with any user actions, with any client activity. And before any of that causes any logs to roll over, any information to be lost, we want to collect that snapshot before we lose that data. The link provided will send you right to the steps to configure the failure notification and how to get the best capture possible to help out, not just me in support, but also yourself or anyone else that's going to be working on the appliance. A great little status provider, the second bullet on this page, is to check the failure notification status. The status provider here, we do list out a reason. We tell you the date that the error report was created, a reason it was initiated, the status and a few other bits and pieces, but really under the failure notification, the highlight there is on the reason. And if you would proceed to the next slide, we're going to cover that reason just a little bit more detailed. If the failure notification reason reports throttle, then quickly you know that the appliance exhausted some resource. Most of the time it's going to be memory. And a simple snapshot of an error report may help, and it may be beneficial, but we want to go back and we want to look over metrics. And when I refer to metrics, I'm hoping that we have some type of monitoring, some type of metric monitoring, be it ITCAM, be it SNMP, just straight SNMP, it does not matter. But we want to go back and look and see, was there a buildup in connections? Was there an increase in latency? Did the CPU go through the roof? So throttle means just like it sounds. The appliance throttled and reloaded for some reason, and we need to branch out and see why. If the reason code is crash, quite honestly, then there's nothing more for you to do except to gather up the error report, upload it to IBM support, and give us just a couple of minutes to dig through it, to decode it, and just put together a timeline and figure out what happened. And just to restate, though, these reasons are just like you saw in the previous slide. There are many reasons. I'm covering the most predominant reasons. The reason for user requested or on shutdown, those are pretty common. The real concerns are going to be throttle and crash. Those are going to be your unexpected, what happened, why did it occur, and let's try to debug. Be prepared to, just because you sent me an error report, let's say you were fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your point of view, to get me to work on your PMR when it reloaded due to a crash or a throttle, I would go ahead and prepare and stress that if it is a throttle event, if it is a crash event, we may have to ask for latency logs, because a lot of times memory exhaustion can be easily triggered due to a latency buildup. If you're pushing 1,000 connections per second at 50 milliseconds per transaction, and suddenly somebody slows down and starts taking 5 to 10 seconds to respond, you can do the math to figure out 1,000 connections per second taking that long are going to build up quickly. So latency logs, off-box error level logs, we may request things like metrics, so SNMP again, CSV, dumps of data. We're going to ask for a little bit more, but we have to get that initial trigger event. Was it a single APAR? Was it a buildup of connections, etc.? But this is the quickest route, I promise, to get this resolved. And the last thing, last absolutely not least. Did we check the fix release? Are we in a if you've had the pleasure to come in before and support has said, ooh, you're running basically a firmware version that came out 4 years ago. There have been a few reload fixes since then. Then don't be surprised. I can't stress that enough, but check in the fix list. We tried to improve our notes. We've tried to keep good records out on the web to say, if it was related to SQL, if it was related to MQ, if the reload was related to NFS usage. A lot of times those quick little scans of the fix list can be beneficial. And again, I expect lots of questions, so please be ready after the call or whenever and post them and let us know. I'm good, and I think we can pass on to the next slide.
Moving on to slide 8 and for question number 2, Chin.
Yeah, thank you, Trey. And this is a question regarding the MQ integration points. And I think we have seen that customer asking, how do I inject MQDMO option for response message in Data Power. So that is the question. So slide number 9, please. As you all know, that the MQ front side handler doesn't have a PMO attribute. We have a GMO attribute, which stands for get message option. But when you are putting the message to the queue, you want to use the PMO option. Since the PMO option configuration is not available in the MQ front side handler, you'll need to use in your response role a result action, where in the destination box of the result action, you'll use a MQ URL, as we have shown here, giving the queue manager object and the queue name and specifying the PMO option value. The PMO stands for put message options, and it has got some value that we'll specify. The values are derived cumulatively. So 2052 stands as set, you know, it's called set all context. So if you are using units of work or a sync point, you'll use 2052. If you are using, you know, non-sync point flow, you'll use 2050. So by defining the PMO 2052, if it is sync point flow, or 2050, if it is non-sync point flow, you'll be able to send, put the message to override certain fields in the MQMD. Those fields related to, you know, put application type, put application name, put date, put time, application origin date. Those are the fields in the MQMD. If you want to modify those values, you have to use the set all context. If you want to use the user context, then you will probably use different PMO. Slide number 10, please. For identity context, you will use PMO value 10.0.28 if the MQ object is using units of work, and 10.0.26 if you are not using units of work. The identity context represents fields like a user identifier, accounting token, application identity data. These are some of the MQMD fields. If you want to say, for example, you want to put a username when putting that message, so the user identifier has to be modified. So in that case, you will use the PMO equal to 1028, you know, or to 1026, depending on the sync point flow or not. And those are the two values that we can do through that result action, defining a MQ URL value, you know, URL syntax that we gave to in the example. So slide number 11, please. This is another question that we are also trying to explain, that how to inject MQOD headers using gateway script. As you all know, that Data Power now is supporting gateway script along with the style sheet. We have some examples where the style sheet is provided, how to inject MQOD, the object descriptors. So in this case, I'm just going to provide some example script so that it will show how you can inject the MQOD. The purpose of MQOD is that when a request message comes in, it will have the MQMD, you know, the reply to queue and reply to queue manager values. Now, if you want to route to the respective destination, you have to inject the MQOD structure in the message so that the queue manager can route that message to the final destination. That is the purpose of MQOD. So, slide number 12, please. So the first thing that you want to save the request message, you know, reply to queue and reply to queue manager. So this example, what is showing that it is fast getting the request MQMD using the gateway script. So you have to provide the header metadata module. So that's why you have defined that the require statement. Once you have that, then you get this by using this hm.current.get, and this type MQ provides you an JSON object for the MQMD. Once you get that, then you create a context variable in the gateway script. We have shown you in the style sheet how do you create context variable, but for the gateway script, you define using a session name, and if it is exist, otherwise you create that particular context. The CTX1, the name itself, is the context here. Then you use that to set variables with the string name and the value. In this case, the value request mqmd.mqmd.replyToQueue is the field which will get from that request mqmd, and the dollar sign is given to you so that it will get that particular value instead of getting the JSON object. So that way you will get the right value. And similarly, you get the reply queue, reply queue manager, and that is just setting the context variable. And then you just want to, if you would like to see this thing, put that into system log by using the console module, console.debug or console.error. So that will give you the idea how you will be able to display in the system log. Slide number 13, please. In this particular example, now we have saved those values in the request rule. Since this particular transaction has request rule as well as the response rule, we want to inject those values, we'll inject those values in the MQOD. So the first thing that you create, you just verify if the existing, the session does exist. So you define that again in the response rule, and then you try to print those things to verify that it is getting those values so that it proves that you are getting those values in the response rule. And here is the MQOD structure, which is given in the XML format. You can define this, and if you look at the object name field, you have that ctx1.get variable rq. So that gives you the reply to queue name, and similarly you also define the reply to queue manager, and those are given in this structure. And after you define that structure, you just use the current.set command with the MQOD as the name and the name of the MQOD structure here, based on the variable here. So that basically sets that MQOD for your response rule. When the message will go to the destination queue, the queue manager will know those values and will route to the destination based on the queue, reply to queue and reply to queue manager. It may be that, you know, the reply queue manager may be a local queue manager, or it can be a remote queue manager. So that is the function that the queue manager will have to configure to route those messages. So slide number 14, please. Again, this is another example where we want to show you how you can inject MQMD header using the gateway script. So slide number 15, please. As you all know that we have given examples of MQMD manipulation using style sheet, but this is just an example of a gateway script. Remember, the gateway script is only available in version 7, 7.1, 7.2, and 7.5. It doesn't have, this facility is not available in all earlier versions. So in this case, again, we define the header metadata as a requirement. That's why you have to use that require statement and using that header metadata. And once you have that defined, then you probably define the MQMD structure. Here I'm giving you an example of MQMD and MQRFS2. So those are related. Sometimes we need to use just MQMD, or you may have to also use MQRFS2. So I'm just giving you a combination of both. So in for MQRFS2, your format field should be MQHRFS2. And the other things, you can add whatever fields that you want to change. That gives you the MQMD structure by the variable MQMD, lowercase. Slide number 16, please. Here, we are using the MQRFS2 header, so therefore we define the MQRFS2 and all other name value data and name value using user folder here. Just an example, giving, you know, one, two fields called from and to, and then the bank type, the change back bank type. So these are some fields that, just an example, we define. Now, in this case, you provide the set command, the current.set. You first set the MQMD so that it will have the MQHRFS2 header set first. Then you set the MQRFS2 using the MQRFS2 variable, which contains the structure. The sequence is important. If you do otherwise, it will not work. So you have to first set the MQMD and then MQRFS2. The same thing true for StyleSheet and same thing true for Gateway Script. And once you have that set to just prove, you can output those into the system log at a debug level. That is what you just give with these console statements. So go to the slide number 17. Now I'm going to pass on to my colleague, Dominic, and he's going to talk about the question number 5.
Thank you, Chin. So my topic is pretty specific in the sense that I'm talking about why do logins fail in DataPower when WebGUI SSH is accessible. So in other words, you have the ability to get to the WebGUI prompt where you see, you know, you have to type in your user password, or in the same respect, you can open your SSH session, but that login you attempt fails. So, you know your admin user, you know its password, and that's continuously failing, or, even your LDAP users might be failing if that's what you rely on. Can you move to slide 18, please? So the reason behind this concern is we have what we call RBM settings. RBM settings controls the ability for you to log in. So it's, if you want to, name it, it's going to be your service for handling your login, your access to the device. It doesn't matter if it's SSH, WebGUI, XML management, and also the new REST interface. When you have to log in, it's going to go through this. Now the problem is that if RBM settings goes down for any reason whatsoever, you won't have access to the appliance any further. So, any of those interfaces that we're talking about will be inaccessible, including your administrator user. So your main admin user that you rely on locally will not work. Also, the fallback login feature, which a lot of customers use alongside LDAP, will not work as well, unfortunately. The RBM settings being down, you have to rely on the virtual console or your serial console to log in with the admin user. There's no way around that. Can we move to slide 19, please? So the most common reason for RBM settings going down is LDAP. And I've seen this recently with more frequency, and it's usually due to the SSL proxy profile. So you have your certificate in there. It's easy to forget. It's valid for a year, a couple years. If that expires, the DataPower device will unfortunately bring down the RBM settings object because they reference to each other. So one depends on the other. You obviously can't use your LDAP server without that certificate. The SSL proxy profile, as I said, if it remains in the valid up state, you'll be okay. If it's modified, if you have a certificate expire and it goes into the down state, your RBM settings will also reflect as down, so your login will not work. The SSL client profile, which is something more recent, I believe that's 7.2 and later, correct me if I'm wrong at the end, that has the same problem. If you modify it in any way that you're going to bring that down and it's already tied to your RBM settings, you can also bring RBM settings down. So you have to be very careful about that. Can you move to slide 20, please? So when you get into this kind of bind, as I said before, your only option is to go to the serial console or your virtual console and log in with your admin user. This is the only way to bypass this situation. When you get into your prompt, you want to go into configuration mode, and you have a few options here. You can try just removing the LDAP certificate if you're using like an SSL proxy profile. So you just, you know, you're already in configuration mode, so you're CEO, you press enter, and you do RBM to go into your RBM settings. And inside RBM settings, you can issue the no LDAP-SSL proxy command, and that will remove any SSL proxy profile you have tied. And then obviously you would exit out of that object to save the changes to memory. And at that point, you can test your login and see if it works. If it doesn't, then obviously, you know, you'll have to continue going down this list. If you're using the SSL-client, the SSL client profile, you'd have to remove that in the same respect. Finally, if, you know, either removing the proxy profile doesn't work or your client profile, you can go into the RBM object and just issue the reset command. Obviously, if you have any LDAP settings, those are going to be lost. So I usually recommend just doing a show command, and that'll get you your settings, and you can, you know, copy and paste that into a text file to input them later. But when you do a reset, just keep in mind you're going to lose all your settings, so you're going to have to rely on your local users. But the hope would be is after you exit out of that prompt, your RBM settings comes back up, and your web GUI, your SSH should start working again. And then last but not least, always remember to write mem after you make your changes, because if you reboot the box again, you don't save that to your persistent configuration, you'll be back into that state again. So that's about it. I'd like to pass to Jim for slide 21. How can I manipulate the content type header for request responses on DataPower?
Thanks, Dominic. Slide 22, please. So first I'm going to explain why you may need to do this. Sometimes during the processing policy of a DataPower service, DataPower might change the content type header. Or also, you might be doing some manipulation of the content, and you need to set a certain content type for the next hop, whether it be the client or the server or some intermediate host. Other than that, this can be achieved by using either a set variable action, an SSL style sheet, or a gateway script in your processing policy, which I'll cover in more depth in the next slides. Slide 23, please. So in version 7.2, there was a new variable added, which is supposed to help with proxying the content type. I just want to bring this up quickly for your attention. In case you're already using some of these methods, you may need to be toggling this variable to continue using the set variable actions, as this is supposed to pass them unchanged. You can find further information about this from the Knowledge Center link that's linked in the slides. Slide 24, please. So one of the methods that you can use for send this variable is a set variable action on DataPower. So with the set variable action, in this example, we're setting the service variable set request header. You can't see the full thing, but after that forward slash, it should say content dash type. And then we're signing it with var service original content type, which is a specific service variable on DataPower that holds the original content type. You could also be setting this to whatever value you want to set if you wanted to set it statically instead of doing it dynamically. Slide 25, please. So this is a sample XSLT style sheet that you can customize for your use case. Here it's doing something very similar. It's taking the content type value from the input context, and it's setting the request header equal to this to force it to proxy what originally came in. Again, depending on your use case, you can customize this, and if you want to do this on the response, you'll want to substitute response in this DP set HTTP request header field, which is commented there. Slide 26, please. So it's also feasible to do this with Gateway Script. I believe, as Chin mentioned, Gateway Script's available in version 7.1 and later. So you need to define the header metadata, and then you need to set the content type. In this case, this example is forcing it to be application XML. This is showing how to get this value, and it's just retrieving it, and you can print it out in your logs for confirmation. And there's additional examples about using the Gateway Script on Data Power in the store directory on your appliance and in the Knowledge Center. Well, now I'll hand it over to my colleague Clarissa for the next question. Slide 27, please.
Thanks, Jim. My topic will cover the common reasons for SSL handshake failures. Slide 28, please. So just to give a quick background, the SSL handshake protocol allows the server and client to communicate securely. And there are three main phases to the SSL handshake. The first is the hello exchange, where the client and server hello are sent, containing the protocol version, cipher suites, and TLS extensions. The next is the certificate exchange, where the server sends its certificate to be authenticated by the client, and optionally, the server can request the client certificate for authentication. And last is the key exchange, where the client and server compute the secret key that's used for encrypting the data. Most SSL handshake failures occur during the hello exchange or the certificate exchange if the client and server do not support the same protocol version, cipher suite, TLS extension, or if the server's certificate cannot be validated by the client, and also if the client's certificate cannot be validated by the server if the server opted to require client authentication. Slide 29, please. So in order to avoid these common causes of SSL handshake failures with the Data Power SSL client, you want to make sure that you understand the remote SSL server's requirements and enable the same in the Data Power crypto profile or SSL client profile. And when I say requirements, I'm referring to, again, the protocol version, cipher suites, TLS extension, and so on. And likewise, to avoid handshake failures with the Data Power SSL server, you want to understand all of the SSL client's requirements and enable the same in the Data Power crypto profile or SSL server profile. Slide 30, please. So these are just a couple of examples when checking the remote client or server requirements. I have a typo in the first example, but it should say TLS version 1.0. So if you see that the remote server only supports TLS version 1.0, then you want to ensure that the DataPower SSL client has the TLS 1.0 enabled. Also, as most of you may know, back with DataPower version 6.0, the default protocol version was changed to TLS 1.2 and 1.1 due to vulnerabilities with the SSL version 3. So if you had any remote servers that only supported SSL version 3, then you may have seen handshake failures after the Data Power upgrade. Next example is if the remote client only supports RC4 ciphers, you want to ensure that the Data Power SSL server has those same ciphers enabled. And the third example is an example of a TLS extension requirement. So if the remote server requires server name indication, then you want to ensure that the Data Power client is configured to send that SNI TLI extension in its client hello message. For the last example, if the remote client is not capable of supporting client authentication, then you want to set request client authentication to off in the DataPower SSL server profile. We actually get a lot of PMRs for this scenario where the customer has the DataPower server configured to require client authentication, but when DataPower requests the client certificate, the client either terminates the connection or does not send the certificate at all, which then causes DataPower to terminate. So if the remote client cannot handle client authentication, it's good to just, you know, disable that or make sure that the client is configured correctly. Also, if the client can handle client authentication, then, you know, you just set that to request client authentication to on and ensure that the validation credential of the DataPower server contains the certificate that signed the client certificate or actual copy of the client certificate. Slide 31, and I'll pass this over to Paul.
Thank you very much, Clarissa. Folks, these next two questions deal with FTP. One is just basically a brief answer, whereas the other I will explain a bit. So you can see on question, see the question on slide number 31, what are the DataPower supported SFTP and FTP commands? Can we please move to slide 32? Now, I saw there was a PMR asking this question, and as you can see below, I've included the TechNote links for the SFTP and FTP supported commands. They've been tech notes that have been published for quite some time. For the SFTP link, there's information that describes the SFTP commands that would be used, that would be needed in doing something similar like an FTP GET request. And then for the FTP link, it includes the raw set of FTP commands that are supported. And if you have any further questions on this topic, you can always email me at mcganny@us.ibm.com. My email address is in the beginning of this presentation. Can we please move to slide 33? Okay, question number 9. This question basically asks if anonymous FTP logins are possible with DataPower. And this was another question that we saw in a PMR that we would like to address. Can we please move to slide number 34? Now, the short answer is yes, it is possible. And on that note, without a username, password, AAA policy configured, any username and password will be accepted. So by default, the FTP server front-side handler, it will allow anonymous login. Now, in order to prevent this and force authentication, you will need a username, password, AAA policy for the FTP server, which will control who can and who can authenticate. On the FTP server front-side handler, there's a tab. There's a tab called Control Connection Authorization. And this is what you want and what to navigate to for creating the username and password AAA policy. The policy will do authentication of the usernames and passwords provided to the DataPower SFTP server front-side handler by the FTP client with the user and the pass commands. Can we please move to slide number 35? Once the policy is created and gets a request from an FTP client, if the authentication succeeds, the FTP client, it can use all the features of the DataPower FTP server front-side handler. If the authentication fails, you're going to get a 530 message, and then the user can try to authenticate again. Now, as mentioned, without the username and password AAA policy configured, on this FTP server front-side handler, any username and password will be accepted. And then just lastly, a note, on firmware prior to 7.2, there will not be a separate tab for you to configure the username, password, AAA policy. It will be in the FTP server front-side handler main tab. Can we please move to slide number 36, as I would like to hand off the presentation to my colleague, Chin, for question number 10, how can DataPower support multi-instance queue managers as high availability? Chin?
Thank you, Paul. So can you please pass to slide number 37? The multi-instance queue manager runs as active and standby mode. So one is active, the other instance is always in standby. But in DataPower, when you are trying to use MQQM group, that group needs one primary MQ object and then one or more backup MQ objects, and those MQ objects are always going to be active. So what happens that when you use the MQKM group, those, if you are using multi-instance queue manager, one will be always down because that is a standby mode. So therefore, the MQKM group will take the primary, which is active, or even the one, if the primary is down, it will take the backup as the current primary, but it will throw some of these errors. The errors will be 2059 because it cannot establish a connection. So in that respect, you can configure the MQKM object, the retry parameters. Those retry parameters has four fields. One called the retry interval, retry attempt, then long retry interval, and then reporting interval. So if you use the multi-instance, you may be able to configure those retry, you know, the retry interval, retry attempt, and long retry interval, smaller value, but the reporting interval, if you increase higher, then those errors probably will not be visible as often. But there are some critical MQ errors which will be visible. But however, customers are using this setup, which we have given in a presentation, that the doc link is given here, the data pair integration with the multi-instance MQQ manager. It has got all the details, and you can read through it and see if this will help you, and you can test it if the particular configuration suggestion in that presentation will be sufficient. But, you know, to be honest, the real multi-instance queue manager is not, you know, there is no true support for data pair with the multi-instance, but this is the way that you will make it work. And I think customers are using in the production environment, and it is working. So that's what I think. If you have any further questions, we will be able to answer, you know, either through the email or through the PMR if we need some additional docs and things, if it doesn't work. But let us know. So that's why I want to get your feedback, whoever has posed these questions to us, and take a look at the presentation, see if this will help in your configuration to use the multi-instance queue manager. So I'm going to now pass on to Kathy, so that way, you know, Kathy will follow up with the other questions.
Thank you, Chin. Before we open up the lines for a question and answer session, there was one question that showed up on DW Answers, and Paul will be answering it. The question number 11 is there a way to automatically refresh data power known host keys table?
Thank you, Kathy. I'll take this one. So can you automatically refresh the SSH key? My colleague Trey had answered this in DW Answers, so I'll just paraphrase what he said. This is possible. Now, since this is an object, you could try setting up a scheduled processing rule to run like a SOMA call to the appliance to clear the key. But something to consider is, should this be done and what problems could this cause? Removal of the key could cause a conflict or race condition with a current or beginning of a transaction if the two events, the actual flush and the transaction, occur at the same time. Now, a consideration would be to be alerted before the back ends are changing keys. It's just that, you know, this man-in-the-middle attack is always a concern. Trey, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Not unless whoever posted it has more questions.
Okay, excellent. Kathy, I'll hand it back over to you.
Okay. It is time to officially move on to the live Q&A session. For our 12th question, came in from Bikesh. The question is, how do I check the B2B storage used on the file system for a B2B gateway?
Yeah, I think there are two commands, you know, that you can use those service. So B2B P, encrypted space, and service. So B2BP size. Those are basically will give you the idea, you know, how much the space is being used for encrypted space as well as the metadata that you have saved. These are specific to the domain. And so each domain will use different based on the use case or the data storage. So those are the two commands. I think if you look at Google search, the data power B2B storage size, you'll get these hits. So maybe you can get that information there.
Yeah, just to clarify, Chin, he was looking for per service. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a command for that.
No. For service, we don't, because this encrypted, you know, the space is used for domain for all services, and that's what I think you will get.
Anyone from the panel that would like to add anything to that question?
I still think that the commands are only available in default because the RAID is one partition, so I think it's actually shared. It's not domain-specific either. Unfortunately, you can only see the overall storage for the device. That's a good enhancement request.
All right. Well, in that case, we'll move on to the next question that was in the group chat. Question number two is, how do I capture exceptions thrown from FSH in an error rule in processing policy?
I guess I can start that off. Someone else wants to chime in. The issue you have there is that the front-side handler is pre-processing policy. If you think about the flow of the message request into the appliance, you basically come into the front-side handler of the service. Once you match on the front-side handler, you have to match on, you know, the inbound IP port and method or options allowed. But if a failure, or including SSL, I would assume. I'm not sure what the exact use case you're looking for here is, but the problem is that the front-side handler is the first layer to go through. Once you've mapped and completed the front-side handler, then the request is handed over to the processing policy. The issue that we have is you're not in the processing policy yet. So you fell on the front-side handler. You never made it into the processing policy. The processing policy was not aware of the transaction and thus can't handle an error rule. Did that make sense outside of my mind?
Yeah, you're right, Trey, because the front-side handler is before the processing policy is invoked. Therefore, you know, the error rule will only captures or on-error actions are only captures when it is in the multi-steps.
Right.
It has not reached the multi-steps. So it is unfortunately that we cannot see, but you can debug it. If you want to debug, you may need some packet capture or some additional error, you know, logs that can be verified why it is happening.
Ah, because cleared up some more. Thank you. I hate to say this, Bikash, but reading that last update, I'm a constant pessimist, so I would want to test everything. But I think what you may be referring to is the default error rule that may be catching in some cases. Possibly. I think that would depend on the firmware, how the failure happened, what the failure was. It's possible. And that may be missing in a B2B gateway. I would tend to agree, yes. That's a completely different animal. I wouldn't compare the multi-protocol gateway to the B2B gateway. Do you have a specific error, Bikash, that you were trying to trap on or trying to handle better?
We currently have a question from Bonaventure. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Bonaventure. I have a question on log rotation. Is there any way to control the log retention based on date or based on time? I know we can control it now based on size. So we have situation, we have a use case where we want to retain the log for 7 days.
You're referring to local files, local to the appliance.
That's right. The file base are log target.
Unless someone else on here wants to take that one. So unfortunately, no. But you're correct. Our log targets work based off of file size and number of rotations. We don't have any archival method based on certain cases, date, timestamp, history, or time to live, anything like that. That's where we kind of lean on the fact that it used to be the fact that the design was that the appliance's file system was limited. Granted, it's grown now in recent appliance types, but really that type of functionality has really pushed off appliance to syslogs, to NFSs, to long-term file storage, longer-term file storage.
I mean, your only option really on DataPower itself is to do a scheduled rule. So inside your XML manager, you can define a scheduled rule, and then you have a processing policy you can build, and you can go through XML management. It's pretty tricky, but that's usually how you'd have to do on DataPower.
Well, I'm very aware of the XML manager processing rule. Then what do you do? You just stuff the log? That's not really elegant. What do you do? Do you have like a SOMA, special SOMA API to do so, or what do you suggest I do in the rule?
No, that's what I mean, is you would have to design the logic of what you want to do. It would have to be, it wouldn't be perfect, but I'm saying that's the only way on DataPower I could think of you doing it. You know, whether you go in, you disable the log target, move the file, that can all be done with XML management, but yeah, there would be some caveats to it.
But do we have API to disable that?
I mean, you can disable any object in DataPower with the XML management. It's a set-config, and then you just pass the admin state element and set it disabled.
Well, I guess all that through SOMA. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if we can get his email.
I think Trey, you have my email, right?
we know you fairly well, Bonaventure. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we can get you some documentation on XML management. That's not a problem.
Okay, great. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Right now, speakers, we don't have any questions on queue. You may proceed.
If we go back to the question that we had with the cache tray, I don't know, there has been some updates in the group chat. It says, thank you, Trey. That makes sense. I think in MPGW you have a global error rule, but this is missing in B2B GW. I think you answered his question, and did you have anything else to follow up with him, Trey?
No, it looked like Bikash had left, but my main point was more that it helps a lot if we have a specific case, a specific error or specific set of events. I hate to say it, but everything is – I don't want to apply a general statement a blanket statement to this. He's probably right when it regards – the multi-protocol gateway versus B2B gateway difference. But I think until we knew more, it would be hard to answer that.
Okay. With appliance reload, is there any particular structure to the error report that is generated by the failure notification settings? I'm looking for a way to understand what is in that report so I can eliminate any issues before raising a PMR.
Yeah, so Trey actually replied to this. We do have a tool we call the ERA tool, and that's usually the best program you'll have to break down the error report. There are various things that comes to a reload of the device. You know, what can cause it? You know, is it hardware? Is it software? The ERA tool does a pretty good job of trying to cover both areas, so it might give you an idea of, like, what component caused the reload. You know, obviously, depending on the issue, if you're running an old firmware, you might upgrade to resolve it. Otherwise, you might end up having to open a PMR to get investigated further. But, yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things. You know, you look at your logs to see what happened. You know, did it hit an error rule? Did it get into a loop or something? You know, you can use the background packet capture. What part of the transaction was it failing on the request response? How far did it get? There's lots of ways you can go about it. But, you know, as far as how far you want to go, that's up to you. But, you know, we'll be ready to take your PMR, so.
You know, also I would like to point out on that line that the tool will also provide you some guideline if you have misconfiguration, it will point out to those misconfigurations based on the best practice. So that gives you a little bit, you know, clear understanding, you know, whether those misconfigurations are contributing or not, especially the MQ area and a few other, you know, component area.
Okay. Thank you very much. Raymond, one last check. Nothing on the phone line?
Oh, we still don't have any questions on you.
Point. We are going to move on to slide 40, and I'm going to pass it back to Paul for a summary of today's session. Paul?
Thanks, Kathy. So, everyone, I would like to sincerely thank you on behalf of the team in joining us for this technical exchange. As you can see by the presentation, DataPower provides quite a wide breadth of integration with a number of technology components, and what you've seen here are just a few. And we hope to see you all on another WSTE session, and have a great rest of the day. And, Kathy, I'll pass control back to you, if that's okay.
There is one question in the group chat about where if we can share the presentation. If you need to go get a copy of the presentation, an easy way to do it is go to IBM.com and enter this number in the search box. The number is 704-8270. That will generate a record that will have this presentation within it. I want to thank Clarissa, Dominic, Chin, Jim, Trey, and Paul for a great presentation. This is very interesting, and I think everybody enjoyed it. I thank you all for taking the time to do this. At this time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session. Thank you very much for joining us today, and a sincere thank you to our panel of experts for presenting today. You all have a great day.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you all.